the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Some of you may know that last week the 1,000th execution took place in the United States of America after the U.S. Supreme Court nearly 30 years ago reestablished the death penalty. And there is a hot debate now raging across the country about the death penalty and about specific applications of it. Some of you may be aware of the case of Tukey. And if you're not, we're going to be talking about this founder of the Crips, one of the gangs in L.A., whose scheduled execution is a big topic of controversy across the nation. But we're going to be taking a look at the death penalty. From a Christian perspective, how do we put all this together in light of contemporary developments and some of the issues that we now face? We'll get to that in just a few moments. First, a review of issues in the news. The United States Supreme Court... The United States Supreme Court on Tuesday is scheduled to consider whether the U.S. government may withhold funds from colleges that limit military recruiters' access to campuses in order to protest the Pentagon's policy, don't ask, don't tell, concerning homosexuality. Folks, what's really going on here is that the law known as the Solomon Amendment, which says that colleges will be denied federal funding if they deny recruiters access to their campuses, that this law is unconstitutional. A federal appeals court has ruled that it is unconstitutional for the federal government to say that we will cut off funding if we do not have access with military recruiters. Now, the Solomon Amendment was passed because Congress believed that national security was actually at stake. But what really bothers me in the midst of all this, as the Supreme Court is set tomorrow to hear these oral arguments, is the definition of academic freedom that is really being trumpeted here by 30 law schools and law faculties that are behind this. As a matter of fact, as many as 38 schools may be a part of this lawsuit. And here's the big deal. Why should the federal government have to acknowledge that it is an unconstitutional abrogation of freedom of speech just to allow military recruiters on the campus? When these recruiters come, students and faculty, and for that matter, virtually anyone else, would be free to protest. That would be a limitation on academic freedom if the federal government said, you can't protest what we're doing, or you can't protest what we represent, or you can't protest the war. But what we have here are faculties, and you talk about a regime of political correctness. Here you see it directly in the face. You're talking about faculties and law schools that say, we will not allow federal government recruiters to come in and try to recruit these law graduates for the Adjutant General Corps of the military because we do not want them to have any part of this campus or any access or visibility on this campus because of the don't ask, don't tell policy. Now, let me just tell you, if this federal appeals court decision stands, then insanity is going to reign on college campuses where it's not already in control. Because what this means is that the federal government is supposed to say, we'll continue to give money, but there are no strings attached. Because that's exactly what these schools are demanding. Just imagine if you were a donor to a school and the school said, we're not going to allow you on the campus, but you have to keep giving. That's exactly what's at stake in this law school. We'll be watching this this lawsuit. We'll be watching it very closely. Let me ask you a question, honestly. Is Christmas getting too commercialized, or is it not commercialized enough? You know, when you listen to some of the debates out there these days, it's hard to know which side some people are on. Last year, we did a Scrooge alert. We were watching very closely what was happening when, for instance, parades were changed from Christmas parades to holiday parades. Or when people said, look, you can't have a Christmas tree in the courthouse because that's an establishment of religion. Or when companies said to their employees, you can't say Merry Christmas. Well, folks, I'm all over that. That's ridiculous. That is a denial of religious liberty. It is a denial of the obvious. I mean, after all, when the federal government has a legal holiday on December 25th, is it supposed to be because they just chose the 25th of December for no reason in particular? But I have to tell you, I think some Christians are developing an exceedingly thin skin. And I'm listening to many Christians say, well, you know, we just need to get these stores and malls and all the rest to make it all about Christmas. Well, let's just remember what these stores are trying to do. They are trying to make a profit. They are trying to sell product. They are trying to entice you in order that you will buy things that you will give during the Christmas season. And, you know, it used to be that Christians were very concerned that Christmas was getting too commercial. Now there are some who think that maybe it's not commercial enough. I don't know that there's any just a clear and an absolutely irrefutable principle that we should put into place here. But I would suggest that we ought to make sure that we are celebrating a Christian Christmas before we start going after all those who may be confused about the holiday season or whatever it is they call it. Yesterday when I was preaching at my church, I said, look, this is the deal. Make sure that your Christmas cards have a Christmas message. Make sure that your Christmas conversation is about Christ. Make sure that you are focused on this. Use it as an opportunity for winsome witness, but I don't think it's really effective to say we're going to boycott a company because it has Happy Holidays out front rather than Merry Christmas. Yes, I'm very disappointed at the secularization of the culture. We talk about that a lot. Yes, I'm very, very concerned about the regime of political correctness and how it is constricting Christian liberty. But I have to say, if we as Christians are known mainly for complaining about happy holidays at the store of all things or out in the public square, then we're probably missing something. Ellen Goodman of the Boston Globe is one of the nation's most influential op-ed writers, and, you know, I rarely agree with her. She's predictably liberal on almost anything, and she has a major column out on gay rights, nurture versus nature. And she's making the point, and I'm going to quote from her here. She says, well, it turns out that the more you believe homosexuality is innate, the more accepting you are of gay rights. A full 79% of people who think human beings are born with a sexual orientation support gay rights, including civil unions or marriage equality, but only 22% of those who believe homosexuality is a choice agree. Now, let me tell you what I find absolutely fascinating about this article. Ellen Goodman has a central point, and that point is this. More and more people are going to believe that homosexuality is an innate condition. The more people believe that homosexuality is an innate condition, the more accepting they are of homosexuality. Well, she just might be right. But she contrasts that. Then, in other words, she may be right that as people begin to accept that, they're going to be more accepting of homosexuality. I really don't deny that. I think that's the agenda of the homosexual movement, as a matter of fact. But then she contrasts that with choice. Now, here's the problem. That really isn't a good dichotomy. That's not really the right and fair way to set up the argument. Because I believe that homosexual behavior is a choice, like every other kind of behavior, including heterosexual behavior. It is a choice. We choose how to use this gift of sexuality that God has given us. But when it comes to desire, or what we might call an erotic profile, or the kind of erotic urgings that a person has, these may be deeply rooted in many kinds of things, in terms of experiences that are not even understood to the individual as a child grows up. And who knows how all of this comes together in terms of whether they consider themselves attracted to men or to women, depending on whether they are a man or a woman. You know, we should not put choice on the one hand and innate attribute on the other, because I don't believe for a minute there's any scientific evidence that it is an innate attribute linked to genes or anything else. But we need to make very clear that every single human being is responsible for the choices that we do make, and that includes the choices about sexuality. But that means also that when we're trying to understand something as complex and difficult as homosexuality, it's not sufficient for Christians to say, well, they just chose that. Who knows, you know, where a certain desire or a certain tendency comes from? We need to be very, very careful not to lie about those who are struggling with homosexuality by telling them they simply chose to be directed this way. No, I'm going to concede right up front that I think that most of the people I know who have struggled with homosexuality will say they would not have chosen this struggle. But folks, the big issue is whether they chose it or not, they're going to choose what to do with it. Just like every single human being is going to choose what to do with this gift of sexuality. And so we as Christians need to say to people, the first issue is, we understand that sin is such an incredible corrupting influence that it has messed up virtually everything. The entire creation is groaning under the weight and the corruption of sin. And certainly that would include our sex drives and everything that makes us who we are. But that doesn't mean that we then have no choice in the matter. The choice is what we're going to do with it. And what we as Christians need to do is to minister to people so that they would choose to align themselves with God's pattern of sexuality as described in Scripture and with God's best plan for their lives and God's best purposes for giving them this gift in the first place. Ellen Goodman thinks that there's obviously that a tidal wave of change that will lead to the normalization of homosexuality because more and more people, regardless of evidence, just because it's politically correct, believe that it's an innate capacity. And she contrasts that with those who don't believe that homosexuality is right, who supposedly just stand back and say, it's just a choice, so choose something else. Somewhere between those two false positions is where Christians need to give a lot of attention to thinking and to loving and to ministering to those who are in the struggle. The one thing we can't do is back off even one centimeter from what God says sex is all about and what God's plan is and what God says about homosexuality. Now we have a choice. What are we going to do to minister to people in this struggle? We'll be back to talk about the death penalty in just a moment, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Last Friday, Kenneth Boyd of North Carolina was executed for murdering his wife and her father. He became the 1,000th individual executed since the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. And there's a lot of conversation about the death penalty, not only in this country, but around the world. And this is the intersection of so many different issues we've been talking about on this program. Human dignity, human rights, right and wrong. The right kind of penalty for the right kind of crime. When you're looking at lining this up, saying, or do we have the right understanding of what the death penalty is all about? Is the death penalty applicable and right under any circumstances? If such, which? I've argued that it is. I've been giving the case on this program as to why. But now you have all this reevaluation and some hand-wringing going on. And it's not just about the 1,000th execution, but one that would be very close to the 1,001st, and that is the execution of a man in California that is now scheduled. And in this case, you're talking about Samuel Williams, better known as Tukey Williams, who was the founder of one of the most notorious gangs in California, the Crips. He was condemned to death for killing four persons in brutal murders. And since then, however, he has created different groups, including the Tukey Peace Patrol. He's written children's books. He says he's been rehabilitated, and he's even been nominated by his supporters for a Nobel Prize. You know, strange stuff going on here, to be honest. And with Tukey Williams, we're really looking at one of those cases in which Hollywood has jumped on the bandwagon. Danny Glover is calling for him, his sentence to be commuted. He said, quote, let Tukey Williams live. He must live. We must demand he lives. We demand our children hear our voices. What exactly Mr. Glover meant by that, I'm not sure, in terms of the let our children hear our voices. Bianca Jagger, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, the usual suspects are lining up in order to demand that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger commute the death sentence of Tukey Williams. Now, interesting points are being raised on the other side. First of all, the brutality of the murders. He committed his first murder while robbing a 7-Eleven with three associates in 1979. He ordered a man into the storage room at the back of the store, made him lie down, and then shot him twice in the back. And the man had offered no resistance whatsoever. He later, that is, Tukey Williams, later mimicked the dying man and laughed about the murder. By the way, the robbery netted about $120. 2 weeks later, he robbed a motel of $100 and murdered three people, including several Oriental persons, the three here. He shot their 43-year-old daughter of this couple once in the back and once in the abdomen. And, you know, what you have here is a man who's never even admitted that he did these crimes. He has never confessed to these crimes. He's asking for forgiveness. He's asking for his sentence to be commuted, but he has never, ever admitted doing the crimes. You know, this really does raise a host of issues. But there is also evidence that the death penalty is slipping in terms of public confidence. Just 10 years ago, 80% of the American people said they supported the death penalty. That slipped to about 2/3 of the American people. Now, I'm going to suggest that the penalty has not changed. What's changing is the consciousness of a country, and there are probably many reasons for this. After all, you have the academic elites who've been going after the death penalty, saying that it is cruel and unusual punishment. You have a liberal culture that is adamantly committed to an idea of rehabilitation for any kind of crime. There's almost no one they would ever admit should ever be executed under any circumstances. They want the death penalty to be completely eliminated. Then you have justices of the U.S. Supreme Court who are increasingly looking to foreign courts for authorization and for models of how they should decide cases. And, well, you can imagine where that's going. And by the way, on the death penalty, liberal justices go to Europe for precedence. They're not going to Asia, for instance, or to Arab countries. The big question is, what should we do with the death penalty now? What about Tukey Williams? Have you been following this case? What would you think about this? What happens when a man commits brutal murders and then claims in prison to have been rehabilitated? What if he's written children's books and formed Tukey's Peace Patrol? You know, what do we do with that? Does that change the nature of the crime and the appropriate penalty? Do you believe in the death penalty at all? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You know, several people and influential posts in the media have said that all this should lead to a reconsideration and a new conversation about the death penalty. So let's just start it here. Let's have that conversation. Let's talk about why, if, when the death penalty is appropriate. Let's talk about the complexities and the moral controversies associated with the death penalty in the United States. Let's talk about the case of Tukey Williams, or you may want to talk about the 1,000th execution that took place last week. I mean, after all, you're talking about something like 250,000 murders and only 1,000 executed during that same time period. That ought to tell you something right there. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Mike calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Mike, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. Thanks for having me on. Listen, I'm not sure exactly how I feel about the death penalty in an emotional way, but one thing that I've always thought about, and I'd like your point of view on this, one thing that I've always thought about is that Jesus was, in fact, put to death due to the death penalty, and if we're capable as a people or as a race of putting our Savior to death by the death penalty, then how can we continue to think that it's a useful or purposeful institution?
That is an interesting angle on it, Mike. As a matter of fact, I wasn't sure where you were going to be going with that. You know, I would say this, that nowhere in the Bible is the death penalty condemned, even when it had to do with Jesus. Of course, it's difficult to use the death of Christ in any meaningful sense here in a conversation about capital punishment. He was, after all, the lamb slain before the foundation of the world. He came to die. And so when we look to the cross, we do not see it as for instance, a failure of human justice, although we understand that Jesus was wrongly accused. But we do understand that he came in order to bear our sins as our substitute on the cross. I do find it very interesting, Mike, that the early Christians, even immediately after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, in the earliest times, accepted the capital punishment as a necessity. As a matter of fact, the Apostle Paul, writing to the church at Rome, of course, in Romans chapter 13, is very clear about capital punishment being the proper role of the state, a proper power of the state to execute with the sword. And so, you know, I just have to go back, Mike, and say, evidently, the earliest Christians did not make any connection there against the death penalty because of the wrongful execution of Christ, from the viewpoint of human justice, wrongful execution, because they understood that he had come to die. And, I just have to go back to what the apostles said as they were preaching on the day of Pentecost and before the Sanhedrin. Peter on the day of Pentecost, Peter and John before the Sanhedrin. This was God's plan. Now, I, for that reason, just would be very, very cautious about applying the death of Christ to any controversy about the death penalty, because I would argue that's just not the same thing. We know that Christ was innocent. That's the whole point. But what about the execution of the guilty? That is the big question. Mike asked a very sensitive question, though, beyond that. He said, why do we trust our own, or how can we trust our own ability, really, to know whether someone is guilty? Well, that's why we have the due process of law, and that's why we have lengthy evidentiary hearings, and that's why we have a judge and oppositional attorneys. That's why we guarantee a person who's accused of any crime the right to legal assistance. But in the end, Mike raises a good point. We are fallible. That's one of the arguments being used against the death penalty. Mistakes can be made. We are human beings who can make mistakes about anything given our best efforts. There is no perfect system of justice among humankind. That just isn't going to happen. But is that an excuse for not applying justice as faithfully and as accurately as we can? Big questions here. 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This is the place to raise the intelligent questions. We're going to do our best to have an intelligent Christian conversation about the death penalty. Join us. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're discussing the death penalty. It's a big issue of current controversy, not only with the 1,000th execution since 1976 that took place last week, but also with the upcoming scheduled execution of Samuel Williams, better known as Tukey Williams, one of the founders of the Crips, found guilty of four exceedingly brutal murders, but supposedly rehabilitated, writing children's books, forming Tukey's Peace Patrol and all these things. He's got Hollywood celebrities coming out to demand that his sentence be commuted. And you have California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger really on the hot seat here, having to decide whether he is going to allow the execution to go forward or if he's going to bend to this kind of public outcry, at least from the Hollywood elite, and commute the sentence. I want to know what you think. What about the death penalty? What about how America is now handling the death penalty? What about these current controversies? The issue and the phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Dave, calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, hi, Dr. Mohler. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great, Dave. Go right ahead.
Good. I just wanted to say I think that the death penalty is effective. It's effective as a deterrent, not only, well, I feel that it's a deterrent to society, but even if it falls short there, it's definitely a deterrent for that particular individual committing another heinous crime. So I think it works for what it's intended for.
You know, Dave, the deterrent factor is a big argument. Let's play that out just a little bit. I think the deterrent factor is one of the biblical grounds for the death penalty. You take, for instance, in the Noahic Covenant in Genesis 9, verse 6, where we're told if by a man's hand another life is taken, then by man's hand the murderer's life should be taken. It is to clearly make the link between the dignity of human life and the great evil of taking that human life. The equation is this. If you, by murder, take someone's life, you forfeit your own. Now, so the first ground, I would argue, in the Bible for the death penalty is simple justice. You forfeit your life when you take the life of another. It just demonstrates how awful, how evil, and how irreversible murder really is. But the second issue is deterrent, and I think that's very clear in the Old Testament law as well, that this is for a deterrent factor, and that is also deeply embedded in exactly what the Apostle Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 13. The government does not bear the sword in vain. But Dave, I'll tell you the truth. I think we have severely reduced the deterrent impact of capital punishment by the fact that murderers really do not have any assurance that they're going to be executed for their crime. I mean, you're talking about something like 250,000 murders plus, and only 1,000 executed. And, I mean, all the circumstances and all the legal protections and all the appeals, you know, the average length at one point from conviction to execution was almost 20 years in the U.S. It's a little shorter now, but still you're talking about a long expanse of years. By the time someone's executed, most people don't even remember the crime. I think for the deterrent effect to have any real effect, it has to be more closely related to the crime in the public consciousness. Dave, does any of that make sense?
Yes, I agree with you, Dr. Mohler. I think that swift punishment is a much more effective deterrent. And like you said, most of the time the crime is forgotten before the individual is put to death.
Yeah, I think that's a major factor in reducing the deterrent value. Of course, we wouldn't want to have hasty justice, a rush to judgment. We wouldn't want to eliminate the kind of protections we have in evidentiary hearings and in the rule of law. We wouldn't even want to short-circuit appeals that would be genuinely for the purpose of reviewing the evidence for any misunderstanding. Or, for instance, we have cases now in which DNA evidence was not available at the time of a conviction, but it may be available at the time of an appeal. And, you know, I would argue that we need to take all that into account. I also want to say that I think the death penalty, as it is applied in the United States, is wrongly applied in so many cases. If you are white and rich, the chance of you being executed is almost nil. Not exactly, but close. You know, the fact is that if you are poor and dark-skinned, and especially if you're dark-skinned and you kill a white-skinned person, the statistics just tell us you're more likely to be executed. Now, on the left, they say, well, that's the reason to eliminate the penalty. I think from a biblical perspective, that's the reason to fix the application of justice so that justice can't be bought. you know, socioeconomic should not determine conviction and should not determine the punishment. But, you know, just to quote someone famous for applying this in a different situation, don't nix it, fix it. I think we've got to go in and say, if there are problems with the application of the death penalty, then it is our mature responsibility as a civilization and a culture to set it right. This is an issue of supreme seriousness. After all, we're talking about the supreme penalty. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about the death penalty. Tukey Williams, 1,000 executions since 1976, and what it means today. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back, folks. All across the country, the issue of capital punishment is the topic of a new conversation and all kinds of reasons why that is taking place. Hollywood's pressure on California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger concerning the case of Samuel Williams, better known as Tukey Williams, is one cause of this. But there have been similar controversies over the last several years associated with different individuals. The 1,000th execution in America since 1976 took place last week, and 1976 is the key year because that's when the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty. Not all states have the death penalty. Not all states have a consistent list of applications of the death penalty. But in reality, where the death penalty is applied, it's almost always in this country for one crime, and that is capital murder. Homicide, first-degree murder, premeditated murder, and in some cases that with extenuating circumstances alone that is understood to justify the death penalty. The long process of criminal trial and the long process of appeal leads up to the fact that there is a long, long period between the imposition of the death penalty as a sentence and the actual carrying out of that sentence. There are some people who think that it is per se. Just categorically cruel and unusual punishment, that it's a sign of the barbarity of the American people that we still execute murderers. And there are others who say, look, what we have in this country is the problem that we don't execute enough. Too many people are getting off, and we have too many people getting life sentences that that really deserve death. I want to know what you think. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Brenda calling from Alexandria, Minnesota. Go ahead, Brenda.
Hi. My sister and I were talking about it the other night about this Tukey thing, and neither one of us were real strong on the death penalty. We didn't know how we felt exactly, but we brought up the whole case of the woman that was brought to Jesus that had committed adultery, and the law of the land of that day said that, you know, she should be stoned, and he basically said, you know, any of you without sin, you know, cast the first stone, so she didn't get stoned. So we were wondering if that applied, like, to this. In some way.
Yeah, Brenda, that's a smart question, frankly, and it's one of those that that is often picked up in a conversation about capital punishment. It's found in John chapter 8, and yes, there was the incident in which Jesus, according to John chapter 8 in that text, said to the woman who had been caught in adultery, go and sin no more. There's a very, very fascinating twist in that story that will remain a mystery until we see the Lord face to face. According to John, Jesus confronted those who were about to execute this woman, and he wrote something in the ground. He wrote something with his finger in the dirt. I'd love to know what he wrote. You know, we just don't know what that was. I don't know what exactly that means. I do know that the big factor in that story that is recounted for us by the Gospel of John is comes down to when Jesus said to the woman, go and sin no more. He didn't say, don't worry about it. It wasn't a big deal. He said, sin no more. But, you know, Brenda, I just don't see where in the Bible we have a justification for seeing that as a blanket prohibition of the death penalty when, for instance, and this is a big issue in biblical interpretation, the Old Testament is just abundantly clear in so many cases about the righteousness, I use that word intentionally, the righteousness of the death penalty under certain circumstances. Jesus said that he came to fulfill the law, not to erase even the slightest, you know, punctuation mark of the law. So for that reason, I'd be very reluctant to point to John 8 and the story of the woman caught in adultery as a justification for ending capital punishment. And again, I have to privilege the very earliest Christians and see, did they understand it that way? And it's clear from the writings, for instance, of the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 13 that they didn't see it that way. And so, Brenda, I'd just be reluctant to apply that particular biblical narrative to a discussion of how we should understand the rightness or the wrongness of capital punishment per se. There are all kinds of situations in which we will want to ask questions about a specific case. And I think that's what's going on there. Thanks so much for your call. We appreciate you listening on XM Satellite Radio and giving us the call. Brenda, let's go to Deborah calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hello.
Go ahead, Deborah.
Yes, my question was around the same lines as hers. My problem with the death penalty is that God forgives murderers. He forgave David, and David was a murderer, adulterer. And also, you quoted a scripture in Genesis about an eye for an eye. But in Matthew, it also says when Jesus teaches the disciples, do not repay an eye for an eye. So what are your thoughts on that? And one other thing is that you also mentioned mentioned the law, but we're no longer under the law.
Well, we're not under the law in one sense. You're exactly right. We're certainly not saved by the law. What the law was powerless to do, God did for us through Christ. But it's not as if we live without law. You know, in other words, and Paul was very, very emphatic about that, as were the early Christians, and as was Jesus, saying the law didn't pass away. It's being fulfilled. And, I mean, we certainly don't want to live in a situation of lawlessness. And even those who are suggesting that we ought to do away with the death penalty aren't saying they should do away with other penalties. And that's what's very interesting. And so when you come down to matters of justice, Deborah, I don't think there's anyone, and I'm certainly not going to put words in your mouth, I certainly don't think you're insinuating or arguing that we ought to get away with all penalties. We have to seek in our very best wisdom and understanding we are fallible human beings to achieve the finest, highest quality of justice. And by the way, I did quote from an Old Testament text, but in Genesis chapter 9, I wasn't talking about an eye for an eye, but rather just this text. It says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And the important part about that text is that it ties the particular crime of murder, of homicide, to the destruction of one who was made in the image of God. Appreciate your call, Deborah. Let's go very quickly to Reggie, listening to WFIA. Reggie, it's your turn.
Yes, Dr. Mola. Thanks for taking the call. Two quick points. I believe the reason for eye for an eye originally was to keep people from exacting more in penalty than what was due. In other words, if someone stole from you, you weren't supposed to go back and steal, you know, three things from them if they stole one from you. I believe God instituted the death penalty because human life was so valuable, you couldn't atone for that crime with an animal sacrifice or with any amount of money. And for those that don't think that the death penalty is a deterrent, look at Ecclesiastes 8:11.
Reggie, boy, you packed more into that short expression and conversation than most people could put in 30 minutes, and I agree with every word you said. I'm just going to close with citing the verse that you mentioned that I was going to point to myself, Ecclesiastes 8:11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are fully given to do evil. Reggie's exactly right, too. The lex talionis, the eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, was to limit retribution and revenge. Wow, there's so much to discuss here. We just really scratched the surface. I'll be back with some final thoughts, and this is going to be an ongoing conversation. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program. Wow, this conversation about capital punishment, as I say, it's just started. And I think it's going to be increasingly an issue discussed across the country. I think you're going to be hearing a lot about it in the media, especially with this Tukey Williams case coming up. But we're going to be tracking this. I think this is where Christians need to get engaged. We need to jump in. We need to think about what the Bible really tells us about the dignity of human life, the cause of justice, and the death penalty, how we are to put all this together. And we're going to keep this conversation going as we follow some of these cases and the evolving controversy. Let's go to Don very quickly here as we end it. And Don, what do you make of all this?
Well, Dr. Mueller, I have been following the Tukey Williams case, and, you know, as horrible as the things that he did and the crimes he committed and what it's turned into with the gang through the years, I sincerely hope that he is now a brother in Christ. But the bottom line is there are consequences to pay for the crime that he did, and our courts have made a decision. And one day, I hope to see him in heaven, but in the meantime, he has to pay the penalty for the crime he's committed. And in the meantime, I think the death penalty is become a watered-down deterrent because it is not carried out within, you know, a year's time, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely, Don. I appreciate that point. And also, you know, what you're really raising is the whole question of justice in the midst of all this and how we are to understand it also in terms of our responsibility to make distinctions. We do have to make distinctions between one crime and another crime. We have to make distinctions between the penalty for that would rightfully be applied under these circumstances and under other circumstances. And we need to make certain that the law is fair. I mean, after all, the statue out front of the U.S. Supreme Court is of Lady Justice blindfolded with the scales in her hands. And if the scales are tilted, if we know that the death penalty is wrongly and unjustly applied, then our responsibility as a people, as a nation, especially our responsibility as Christians, is to set that right. But you also raise the question, and I think this is where a lot of minds right now are trying to think this through. What about what happens after the sentence, after the crime, after the sentence, and before the application of it? Well, you know, what if a person comes to faith in Christ? That would be wonderful. What if a person does many good things, you know, in terms of even like Tukey Williams writing a book for kids and suggesting that they not join gangs? That's a good thing. But it doesn't change the nature of the crime. And in a biblical worldview, the big issue is that the crime itself is what cries out for punishment. A morally serious people must take crime seriously, wrongdoing seriously, and where necessary, I would argue, be willing to apply the most extreme of punishments for the most extreme of crimes. By any measure, this is an extremely important issue. We're going to be back to talk about it, and I'll be back for Intelligent Critics.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.